Okay, slow down a bit, little bit, so we can make everybody to really better understand you. Thank you.
Sounds good.
So your time.
Wonderful. So what we'll try and do then is, I know it's Friday night there, and I hate to take away your entire Friday night, so we'll do our best to make it entertaining. I'll try to talk for just over an hour or so about the empirical studies that I mentioned yesterday. And then hopefully we'll have plenty of time for questions. And if I understand correctly, at the end of yesterday, it was suggested that we could broaden the topic of our discussion near the end. I'm not sure what you'd like to talk about, but Lauren and I are happy to talk about, almost anything. I mean, we're fairly open to that. This is a wonderful dialogue, so that's great. Okay, so I feel like near the end of my talk yesterday, I was getting a little bit incoherent and may not have presented these last two slides in the way that they should have been. So I'm going to spend just a moment talking about the problem that we're dealing with and the relationship to social network analysis. So again, the primary issue that I'm interested in the research you'll see today is this issue of a decline in exposure to diverse ideas, opinions, and beliefs within the public sphere. And the public sphere is being conceptualized here as a multi-step process where we consider both the mass media, digital media, and interpersonal relationships and the implications that this conglomeration of information has for how we're exposed to new ideas and different information and how we form opinions. I'm arguing that there's a trend within American society anyways, and perhaps even broader than that, that is constraining the public sphere in different ways. And that constraint comes in the form of constraint on the mass media, in the form of conglomerization, which is a tendency within at least capitalist societies where large corporations start to take over more and more of a sector to the point where they dominate the sector so heavily that the diversity of ideas expressed through the mass media declines. Global influences, suggesting that there's a lack of local information, convergence of media, which I'm sure I don't have to spend too much time talking about, but the idea that as television, the internet, and other media converge and become the same media, the same medium, that somehow this constrains the type of information that is projected. Intermedia surveillance, a tendency within the United States and beyond for news organizations to pay close attention to what the top stories each one is presenting and tailor their news production to match that of their competitors. There's a wonderful new book coming out by Pablo Bukowski, who is a professor at Northwestern University, who's done some work on this in Argentina, which is very, very interesting. And then in addition to the homogeneity within mass media, the trend towards privatism, which is the article that I had you read on McPherson, Smith-Levin, and Bashir's, which is really an older idea that was developed by Claude Fisher and his studies of how the telephone was changing social networks. And it's the idea that people are becoming more and more home-centered, spending more time in the home and less time interacting with people in neighborhoods and voluntary associations. And then thirdly, changes to the physical form of the urban environment. In particular, things like Disneyfication, which in the United States refers to a trend of something called business improvement districts, where private companies take over public streets and are allowed to change the physical design of those streets and to have private police officers there. And those spaces become very controlled to push out certain types of people who might otherwise be there, so-called undesirables, people of lower socioeconomic status who might make shoppers feel uncomfortable. In addition, things like video surveillance, which has been argued to push out certain types of people from public spaces, making them feel less welcome, and even potentially mobile phone use, which may change how we interact in those public spaces. So the question is, do new technologies advance or hinder these existing trends? So social networks and the public sphere, I argue that there are three realms realms might be a new term here, of social interaction that contributes to the public sphere. And this builds on some work by an urban scholar named Lynn Laughlin here in the United States. The private realm is the home. It is a source of very homogeneous, very, as we think back to yesterday, very homophilous social ties. And as a result, the information that tends to flow within the private realm is very homogeneous. It reinforces, it generally doesn't broaden opinion or exposure. And then there's a second realm, the parochial realm, which is beyond the home. It generally includes neighborhoods and workplaces, more diverse than the home, but yet the location, still relatively familiar others, but yet a source of some degree of diversity in terms of the information, resources in which we're exposed. And then the public realm, which is the most diverse at all. It's those urban public spaces that really minimize the amount of segregation, minimize the amount of purposeful efforts to constrain exposure to diverse people. It favors the unfamiliar. There are very few barriers to entry. Anyone can go there. The idea is that these types of spaces should be providing exposure across ethnic, social, behavioral, and ideological and class boundaries. Exposure is intended to be very primitive and fleeting. You know, we don't expect to gain a lot from just observing people walking around in public spaces in terms of how this may impact people's opinions. But it's just that very fleeting encounter with people who are very different that may provide us with a little bit of tolerance, understanding, and exposure to very different ideas. So I'm going to talk about a series of studies that we've been involved in over the last 10 years or so that deal with social networks in the parochial, public, and private realms. I'm not going to discuss all of these studies, but I'll probably allude to each of them. The first, the parochial realm, I'll start there because it was one of the first studies that I was involved in. The parochial realm primarily refers to neighborhoods in this case. Why is the parochial realm so important? While local social capital still matters. As we learned yesterday, local social ties provide small and large services, including childcare, help in emergencies, home improvements, help borrowing a cup of sugar. Local social ties are still the people you need to rely on during a natural disaster. There's an earthquake, a tornado, a hurricane. Only those people who live nearby can help you with informal social support at a time in need, and they remain important. They're also important for collective action, mobilization, and dealing with local issues. Compared to the private realm of the home, the parochial realm is still a fairly diverse source of cultural and political information. And in the United States, there's been a significant amount of research that has associated the size of local social networks with things like community attachment, empowerment, lower crime rates, the watchfulness of neighbors, surveillance really, reduced fear and mistrust of others, and lower levels of mental and mental distress and depression. So the first study I'll talk about is the Netville study. It's a study that began in about a decade ago now when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto. It was a study I worked on with my advisor at the time, Barry Wellman, who's a sociologist there at the University of Toronto. Netville was a unique case study. It was the first neighborhood in North America that was literally built from the ground up with fiber optic cabling in the ground, followed by houses and then people inside those houses in a suburb that was located outside of Toronto. And the idea was to study how the latest and greatest of technologies might influence people's everyday lives. Tell you just a little bit about the technology that was available. It was fiber optic technology to the home, so extremely fast internet access. Not quite as fast as we're using today to share this telepresence, but fairly close. The type of technology is now only commercially available for homes in the United States in the last 5 years or so. Fiber optic to the home, fast web access. You could video conference with doctors at local hospitals. You could take free online distance education courses from local universities. You could do things like download music and games online. Back in the 1990s, that was, of course, extremely novel. The methodology involved included both an ethnographic portion, where I had the ability to move to this brand new neighborhood, live in a basement apartment for 2 years, and walk around the neighborhood studying people and how the technology influenced them in their day-to-day lives. Literally going to people's houses every time they had a party, hanging out on the street corner, walking around the neighborhood with little maps marking where I saw people standing and who they were talking to, hanging out at the mailbox, participating in every kind of formal and informal aspect of the community that I could to build up some understanding about how use of the technology might be influencing their everyday life. In addition to that, we did a cross-sectional survey where we interviewed people before they moved into the community and after they had moved into the community, and for some who had been there for some period of time, to try and find out how the internet, the introduction of this very advanced internet technology may have influenced their social relationships. There was also a bit of an unexpected twist to the methodology in that people who were purchasing these homes in suburban Toronto were expecting to get this free internet access, this broadband internet connectivity. However, the people who were providing the technology, a consortium of private companies, telephone companies, computer companies, software companies, they were very disorganized. And it turned out that they forgot to connect about half of the people who were supposed to be connected when they purchased these homes in the neighborhood. So we ended up with a sample of half people connected and half people not connected, all who expected to be connected, which, you know, was very disappointing for those residents who did not get connected, but was absolutely wonderful for me as a sociologist, and we had this built-in control group that was very unexpected. So here's an example of the findings. We gave people a roster of everybody who lived inside their neighborhood, and as we discussed yesterday in the network methodology section, people were asked to look at this roster and indicate who they recognized, who they talked to, who they called on the phone, who they emailed, and how often. And what we found was that when we compared the wired and the unwired group who were living in the same neighborhood, the wired residents recognized about 3 times as many of their neighbors. They talked to their neighbors about twice as often, and they tended to visit about 50% as often. And it wasn't just interaction that was taking place online. When we looked at their frequency of communication through other means, we found that they were more likely to meet in person and more likely to talk on the phone, and not just by a small margin, but 4 or 5 times as much. They used the local services in ways that were unexpected. No one pushed them to use the technology in a way that, in a specific way. The idea was that if there was a technology that the residents of this neighborhood wanted, chat rooms, instant messaging, or something like that, the consortium that was providing the technology would then build that technology and give it to them. But what turned out to be most useful and most highly used amongst the neighbors was both the high-speed web access and just a very simple neighborhood email discussion list. And they used that neighborhood discussion list to do everything from exchanging support, looking for other children for their children to play with, help with kids' homework, looking out for crime in the neighborhood, reporting back on activities at local town meetings, sending representatives to those meetings to take notes and then give those notes back to the residents through the neighborhood email list. They organized barbecues, parties, search for pets. You name it, the neighborhood email list was an unexpected source of local action and local social tie formation. What was rather unanswered at the end of the Netville study was whether we would expect to see the same thing in different neighborhoods. We didn't know if Netville was unique, either because there was a sociologist living in the basement, or if because it was in Canada, or because it was so new. We didn't know if the trend we were observing, a tendency for local uses of the internet, was a more generalizable trend that was a result or would result from internet access spreading, you know, more widely, or if this was a very unique situation that we wouldn't see elsewhere. We also didn't know about how different types of internet use might be influencing the structure of people's local social networks. So to try and fill this gap, when I was a faculty member at MIT in the early part of this decade, I started another study called eNeighbors. eNeighbors tried to fill the informational hole here by answering two questions. The first was, isn't the internet an increasingly part of everyday neighborhood interactions? And the second is, under what context can internet facilitate the formation of neighborhood social networks? The eNeighbors study involved four different neighborhood settings. These neighborhood settings were all middle-class neighborhoods, but the idea was that we were selecting people who are similar class, but who varied in terms of their stage in the life cycle. And that turns out to be important because we know from some literature in the United States, and actually some literature that's developing in China as well, that there tends to be a self-selection for different types of housing type based on stage in the life cycle. For example, in the U.S., people who live in apartment buildings, they tend to be younger, they tend to be single, they tend to be more transient, meaning they move more often, they tend to be less stable in their careers and in their life in general. People who move to suburban neighborhoods, they tend to be a little bit older, they're more likely to be married, they're more likely to be at a stage in their life when they're thinking of having children. And as a result, when we contrast these different neighborhoods, we see that people who live in apartment buildings tend to not be very interested in neighborhood social interactions, or people who live in suburban developments tend to be very interested in local neighborhood interactions and local community in general. We also had an example of a gated community here, and gated communities are a phenomenon in the United States and beyond where neighborhoods literally have physical gates or security guards who try and keep out non-residents and limit access only to the people who live in those communities. They're fairly controversial here, as they are in many other places. The idea was that we were going to use these four different neighborhoods as a comparison. Three neighborhoods were going to be given the technology, and a fourth neighborhood, a second suburban neighborhood, would serve as a control group. So in June of 2002, everybody in this neighborhood, in three of the four neighborhoods, were given very simple internet services. They were not given new internet access. They were not given new computers. If they did not have internet access, they could not use the technology that we were giving them. If they had basic internet access, we gave them access to essentially a neighborhood website and a neighborhood email list. The neighborhood website was not intended to be new and exciting. It was intended to replicate existing services that were on the internet, something along the lines of a neighborhood Facebook, where you had a profile. It showed you who in your neighborhood was similar to you, a neighborhood directory, calendars, something to survey or poll your residents about different topics, recommendation system, and so on. Everybody was interviewed at the start of the study, before they were given the technology. And then when those neighborhoods were given, three of the four neighborhoods were given the technology, we returned and interviewed them every year after that for 2 years about how the technology might be changing the structure of their social networks. We didn't encourage residents to use the technology in any way. In fact, the idea was to see how this would develop naturally if the technology was just available as part of kind of the natural environment. So we gave them a postcard every 6 months or so that said, remember, you're part of a study. You could use these neighborhood internet services if you want to, but if not, we're going to come back in another 6 months and interview you again anyway, and the study will continue. So this is an example of the neighborhoods that were part of the study. This is an apartment building in Boston that is relatively famous. It's the "if you lived here, you'd be home now" apartment building. That are these signs are actually historical monuments to a time in Boston when very dense inner city neighborhoods were routinely redeveloped to cure what was called urban blight at the time. And a very famous American scholar named Herbert Gans wrote a book called The West End. Urban Villagers, which was about the West End of Boston and an area that was considered a slum by the city government. And he went in and did an ethnography of this urban space and discovered that lo and behold, there was a great deal of social cohesion and strong social ties existing within the small urban area that everybody considered to be a ghetto. But yet, even though there was these strong social ties, the neighborhood could not rise up and find a way to mobilize against the city government, who decided to take their homes and flatten the neighborhood and replace it with these very big apartment buildings. This particular study is rather important for us in that it became the inspiration for Mark Granovetter's article on the strength of weak ties. And in that article on the strength of weak ties, he talks about Herbert Gans's West End and why these residents, with their strong, cohesive ties, could not organize and deal collectively with the threat they faced from their local government. And the answer that Mark Granovetter presented, of course, was it's because they lacked weak social ties. They lacked these weak social ties that would have allowed them to organize more successfully. So this is one of the four neighborhoods in our study, the apartment building in West End of Boston. This is the gated community that we studied. Interestingly, it's not technically a gated community. There are just surveillance cameras located at the entrance and private security guards that would walk around to make sure that you lived in this neighborhood and were allowed to be there. And these are the two suburban neighborhoods, the experimental neighborhood and the control group, which are, it's actually an older suburban neighborhood outside of Boston called Lexington. This slide here gives a breakdown of some of these survey results about the types of neighborhoods that we observed. So as we expected, the different types of neighborhoods were people in different stages in their life cycle. So we learned, for example, that most people in the apartment building were younger, single, childless, transient individuals who really had little to do with their neighborhood. But despite that, they really wanted to know more about their neighbors. The people in the gated community, they were older, they were more established, they were stable, they were married or childless. They were very split in their level of involvement. This was our only neighborhood in our study that had what was called a homeowners association, which is a trend in the United States where neighborhoods are given a certain amount of local control over certain local facilities in their neighborhood. They're responsible for maintaining their own streetlights, having the snow taken off of their own roads, maintaining the outside of their buildings as a collective rather than as individual homeowners. And as a result, they're required to appoint a board of directors from the residents and elect them and become somewhat involved in their local community. And it was the only neighborhood that we studied of this type. But what we found was that those people who had been very involved in their homeowners association were very fed up with their neighbors and didn't want anything more to do with them. But those who hadn't been involved in such an association were still very interested in local community. Our two suburban neighborhoods were, as we expected,